Patrick Ryan v. the U.S., 12-3398. Mr. Parker, hi.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Jonathan Parker, and I represent the appellant, Patrick James Ryan. Your Honors, a secured claim to which Section 506 does not apply is an oxymoron. Judge London wrote those words in a treatise on bankruptcy practice, and I agree with him. The question presented by this case is whether and to what extent that is a true statement in the Seventh Circuit. Resolving that question requires us to resolve two prior questions. The first is, how is a bankruptcy code written and designed to function? The second, how will the bankruptcy code actually function after the Supreme Court's seminal decision in Doosnip versus Tim?
I want to stop you and ask you this. Would your argument create a split between this circuit and the Tenth Circuit's decision in Woolsey? And has any other circuit taken the position that Woolsey was wrongly decided?
To answer the first part of that question, yes, it would. Woolsey said that the Section 506D cannot be used to avoid a lien because of how it interpreted the Supreme Court's decision in Doosnip. Woolsey was so recently decided that, to my knowledge, there is no other court that has come out yet to say that it was wrongly decided.
Now, you never objected to the government's proof of claim, right? At least I haven't seen any indication there was an objection. So can you explain why the government's tax claim isn't an allowed claim?
Well, that's been an argument that I have had in this case as well as the other cases that we have pending in the lower courts, which is that the adversary proceeding is an objection to the proof of claim because objections to proof of claim are governed by Rule 3007. And what Rule 3007 says, an objection to proof of claim must be in writing and mailed to the claimant at least 30 days before the hearing. So the adversary proceeding in this case would satisfy that requirement. To say that, it has to be titled objection, I think, elevates form over function. In addition, it's impermissible under Rule 3007B to include in an objection to a proof of claim the relief specified in Rule 7001. So there's one other case that has an identical legal problem, and that was it's in the record, not in the appendix. It's in Re Nix, where the district court agreed with the position that the adversary complaint constituted an objection to the proof of claim. And I point out that that actually works both ways. If the government believes that we haven't objected to their proof of claim, I think they have the same obligation to object to the plan if the plan proposes to treat them in a way that they don't think that we can treat them. Now, in this case, the government did eventually file a proof of claim, an objection to the plan, but it was after my original brief was filed. So it took them a year and a half to object. I think that the smoother way to handle the case is to say that we're required to object to the claim, but that the adversary proceeding was such an objection. And when you look at the agreed judgment on count two, the proof of claim was disallowed at least to the extent that it sought priority payment for the 2006 income tax debt. So, because that is how that played out, I think that the court really should conclude that the adversary complaint satisfies the requirements for an objection to a claim, even though it's not titled objection to claim. There's not a reason to say, well, we have to file both an adversary under Rule 7001 and a separate objection under 3007. It makes more sense to combine the two proceedings into one. Then when we look at how the code was written, I think that Sections 1322 and 1325, which the bankruptcy court and the government contend are the proper ways to avoid liens, always presuppose the prior operation of Sections 506A and B. What we can all agree on.
Yeah. No, what finish we can, your thought, because...
What we can all agree on is that Section 103A requires that Section 506 apply evenly to what I'm going to refer to as the functional chapters of the Bankruptcy Code, 7, 11, 12, and 13. So when we look at how that's written, we say, okay, this has to apply evenly, but when we see that the language of 1322 and 1325 refer to either the rights of secured claimants or an allowed secured claim, it makes sense procedurally to say that those determinations get made first under 506A. 506D then is self-operating, with some exceptions, is self-operating once the collateral supporting the lien is valued. And then 1322B2 isn't a sword available for use by bankrupt debtors. It's a shield available for use by certain secured claimants. 1325A then is nothing more than an instruction to a bankruptcy court as to when it must confirm and when it must not confirm a plan. It also contains cognizable objections that can be made by both secured and unsecured creditors. But nowhere in either of those provisions are the words lien or avoid found. And when we look at case law that develops after the Doosnip decision, and particularly Nobleman, what they say is the primary focus of the Bankruptcy Code is not to distinguish between secured creditors and unsecured creditors, but to distinguish between secured claimants and unsecured claimants. And
the court in Doosnip was really concerned that an involuntary reduction of a creditor's lien could violate the takings clause. And isn't that constitutional concern equally applicable to Chapter 13 cases?
It is, but not this case. And the reason it's not applicable to this case, there's a couple of reasons. The first is that the government does not enjoy the same kinds of protections that a private lender would enjoy. The second is that the protections that are built in for secured claimants are found with respect to Chapter 13 at 1322B2 in mortgage lenders. Because what the Bankruptcy Code does is it freezes the secured creditors, the secured claimants' property rights as of the date of the filing of the bankruptcy petition. That's what 506A2 says. So what we have to do is we have to say, okay, if there's a secured claim, I'm in my rebuttal time, so I'll finish this thought. If we have a secured claim, that secured claimant must receive an amount of money equal to the value of the collateral on the petition date. And I'll reserve my remaining time.
Thank you very much. Ms. Wolitzer.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Good morning. My name is Rachel Wolitzer, representing the Appellee of the United States.
Are there any cases, to your knowledge, that have interpreted 506D in the Chapter 13 context in the manner that Ryan would have us interpret it?
I'm not aware of any. There may be some cases that have held that lien stripping is allowed in Chapter 13 cases, but those cases have looked to the specific Chapter 13 provisions, which we discussed in our brief, that discuss the treatment of liens in a Chapter 13, which was the argument that we made in our brief, that 506D does not provide for a wholesale voiding of liens that are not fully supported by collateral.
And I have one other question that I'll let you know. But how would you respond to the argument that all of the cases holding that Doosnip prohibits the use of Section 506D to avoid non-consensual liens were cases involving debtors who owned real estate and were in Chapter 7 proceedings? I mean, would that be a relevant limiting principle?
Well, Your Honor, there was a case cited in our brief, the Doviak case,
yeah,
that held that Doosnip applied even though there was no real property involved in that case. That case involved only exempt personal property, as in this case, and the court in that case rejected the debtor's argument, the same argument made here, that Doosnip didn't apply. And there have been the Ninth Circuit bankruptcy appellate panel in the Con Cannon case, in our cited in our brief, and other lower courts have held that Doosnip applies to non-consensual liens, including federal tax liens and other statutory liens, as well as consensual liens. So there is no basis for distinguishing Doosnip on that ground.
And you say that Ryan never objected to the tax claim in this case, but aren't you really taking form over substance, because isn't the complaint that was filed essentially his objection?
Your Honor, it could have been if he had included an objection to the tax claim in the adversary proceeding, but he did not. He admitted that he owed the tax liabilities. He admitted the amounts that he owed. He admitted that the claims were secured under that, or at least that notice of federal tax lien had been filed, securing those claims. He admitted, and then later he stipulated to the that he owed the taxes. The specific amounts were set forth. He set forth the specific amounts in his complaint. So an objection to claim has to, we discussed this in our brief, there are specific grounds for an objection to claim set forth in Section 502B. And none of those, this is discussed on page 63 of our brief, and none of those grounds were included in his complaint, in his adversary complaint. It was clearly a complaint to void the liens. Also, he did have claim to determine priority and dischargeability, but there was no objection to claim. An objection to claim is where you object to the liabilities on the claim, and he did not include that. He could have, and he did not, because he was not disputing the liabilities. So our basic argument is that the bankruptcy court correctly held that under the Supreme Court's decision in Doosnip, 506D did not authorize the voiding of the federal tax lien. Doosnip held that 506D does not authorize the voiding of a lien securing an allowed claim. The Doosnip decision was broadly worded. The first paragraph states the issue in the case and is not limited in any way by chapter. 506D states, to the extent that a lien secures a claim against the debtor that is not an allowed secured claim, such lien is void subject to two exceptions. Both of these exceptions relate to disallowed claims. So they're making an exception. Even though disallowed lien securing disallowed claims would be void, if the claims are disallowed under the exceptions, then they wouldn't. Those are the only exceptions, and the exceptions relate to domestic support obligations, claims against the debtor for contribution, and claims where the creditor failed to file a proof of claim. So those exceptions are not applicable here. The Supreme Court concluded that the words allowed secured claim in Section 506D is not an indivisible term of art defined by reference to 506A, and that because 506D does not refer to 506A, and 506A is not a definitional provision. Rather, 506A, the term allowed secured claim in 506D, should be read term by term to refer to a claim that is allowed, meaning allowed under 502E, and secured, meaning secured by a lien with recourse to the underlying collateral. The Doosnip case, or the Woolsey case, held in the Tenth Circuit that Doosnip applies in Chapter 13 cases. The debtor made the same argument made by the debtor here, that Doosnip only applies in Chapter 7 cases, and the Tenth Circuit clearly held that the debtor's argument violated the elementary rule of statutory interpretation ascribing various meanings to a single iteration of a statutory term in different applications. The court failed to see any principled way it could hold that 506 has a different meaning in Chapter 13 than in Chapter 7 cases. Woolsey was correctly decided, and we argue that the court should reach the same conclusion. This is, Woolsey relied heavily on the Supreme Court's decision in Clark, where the Supreme Court rejected the dangerous principle that judges can give the same statutory text different meanings in different cases. And in that case, the Supreme Court held that the same detention statute in an immigration context could not be given different meanings for different categories of aliens. Although not without its critics, as recognized in Woolsey, DUSNIP has been the law for 21 years, and neither Congress nor the Supreme Court has seen fit to overrule it. There was a question about whether what other courts have said about the Woolsey case. The case was decided on September 4th, 2012, so it has been around for some time now, and there have been no other cases disagreeing with it. Other appellate and lower courts have rejected attempts to narrow DUSNIP. The Harmon case in the Eighth Circuit held that DUSNIP applied in a Chapter 12 case. There was a Western District of Wisconsin case reversing a bankruptcy court case, the Blue Pacific case discussed in our brief, holding that DUSNIP applied in a Chapter 11 case. And there are the Ryan and Talbert cases held also refused to limit the scope of DUSNIP. The reasoning of DUSNIP also applies here. As Judge Rovner noted, the doctrine of constitutional avoidance applies, even though the government is not a private litigant and therefore wouldn't be affected by a takings issue. In the case we cited and we discussed the issue in our brief under the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, it doesn't matter whether or not the litigant at issue is a private or government litigant because the statute must be applied consistently. So you don't look at who the litigant is in a particular case. You're avoiding an interpretation of a statute that would raise a constitutional issue in any case, regardless of who the litigant is. As we argued in our brief, the treatment of liens securing allowed claims in Chapter 13 cases should be governed by the specific provisions in Chapter 13, which we discussed in our brief, rather than the general provision 506D, which is limited to the voiding of liens securing disallowed claims. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Parker, 2 minutes.
If we read the code in the way that counsel is suggesting, you know, that 1322 or 1325 are specific provisions that govern the more general provision of 506. And I think what we're doing is we're inviting the court to read a conflict into those various provisions. And the case law out there is fairly clear that the court has to interpret different statutes within the same act to work in harmony, if at all possible. There is a way to do that here, and that way is to limit DUSNIP to the facts of that case as the DUSNIP court instructed. The problem really in this case is the bankruptcy court and the government concede that it's a well-established right of a Chapter 13 debtor to void at least wholly unsecured liens. The problem is that nobody says exactly which statute does it if it's not Section 506D. I'd point the court to Sections 348 and 349, which refer to liens springing back into force upon conversion of a case or dismissal of a case. It refers to liens avoided under 506D. If the government is correct as to its interpretation of DUSNIP and the bankruptcy code as a whole, then the number of liens that would spring back into force upon conversion or dismissal would be such a small subset of all liens as to make those sections virtually meaningless. Now, the government would contend that the lien retention language of 1325A would solve that problem, but I think that poses a further analytical problem, which is how do we define the term allowed secured claim? And one of two things is going to happen. Either it's going to be defined by reference to Section 506A, which the government is contending is not a definitional provision, or or it's going to be defined internally to Section 1325, which poses the following problem. Either Mr. Ryan has to pay the entire claim in full, which then what's the point of avoiding liens at all, or Mr. Ryan is still going to owe the unpaid amounts, the unpaid lien amounts post-bankruptcy, and that has a serious policy problem. He should have then filed under Chapter 7. And the point of the BAPCPA amendments is to encourage debtors to file under Chapter 13. I see that I'm out of time, so if there are no other questions from the panel.
No further questions from this part of the panel. No.
Thank you very much.
Case will be taken under advisement.